Welcome to Conservation Connections. My name is Sky Bruce, and I am here with Ellen Voss. My position is the Native Plantings Coordinator and Water Sampling Monitor at the Valley Stewardship Network. And again, I'm here with Ellen Voss from the River Alliance of Wisconsin. So, Ellen, your title at the River Alliance of Wisconsin is Climate Resilience Director. I'm curious, what does climate resilience actually mean on the ground in Wisconsin rivers, farms, prairies, and communities?
Hi. Thanks for having me. That is a very good question. The title of climate resilience director was very intentional. It's a kind of a big umbrella term that lets me cover a lot of bases when it comes to conservation and getting ready for the climate that awaits us here in Wisconsin. Excuse me. So in a nutshell, what we're talking about with that term is how we prepare, how we respond, how we recover, and how we adapt to a changing climate. So there are things that we can do on a community level that make us more resilient to, you know, the big storm events that kind of unify communities. The term resilience, most of us can think of a person in our lives who is very resilient. Like, you get knocked down, you bounce right back. That's what we want in our climates, in our climate as well, in our communities, and, you know, building resilience that helps us survive and thrive in the warmer, wetter future that awaits us here.
Yeah, and you know, there's so much to that, so many facets, and I'm so grateful that we have you here in the studio to talk today to us a little bit about biodiversity. And our special topic of the day is neonicotinoids and how it affects ecosystems all around us. And so you often talk about biodiversity in a way that's very interconnected. So for listeners who may mostly be thinking about conservation as a single species or a place, how do you explain the idea that everything in an ecosystem is interconnected?
That is a really good question, and it's sometimes a hard concept to get across to people. I think single species conservation is important in that it brings attention to a problem that maybe people didn't know that existed before. So a good example of that is, you know, polar bears. They're kind of the icon of climate change. But, you know, it's sad that we're losing polar bears, obviously, but it draws attention to this bigger problem of we're losing habitat. And why are we losing habitat? And that it unpacks this bigger problem of what's causing this problem, how are we all a part of that, and how can we stop it? And so, you know, biodiversity is... it's a hard concept to get across to people, but once you start unpacking it, I think people can really relate to it and can kind of understand what the implications are. A quote that I think about all the time is from Aldo Leopold. He says, "To keep every cog or wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." And from a biodiversity context, that's exactly really relevant. I mean, think about a really tangible example would be an automobile, right? Like, no one would think of popping the hood open and just start randomly pulling out parts and not expecting there to be consequences. It's not safe and it doesn't work. And so the same thing with an ecosystem. All of the parts that exist are super important. Even if we don't realize what they're doing, they're playing a part and they have a role. And so to make sure that everything functions like it's supposed to, it's vitally important that we keep every part of that machine in place so that it works right.
I love that metaphor. That's great. Thanks. So to get into our topic of the day, which again is neonicotinoids, I'd love to just introduce the concept. So for listeners who might not be familiar with that term, what exactly are neonicotinoids and why have they become so widely used? And also, where might we see neonicotinoids pop up?
All good questions. Yeah, so honestly, this topic came on my radar just a couple of years ago. It was a new term to me, but it's sort of gained more attention in the last few years and for good reason. Neonics are a class of chemicals that are widely used in agriculture and elsewhere. They're very effective at pest control, but they're not unique to pests or specific to pests. They kill indiscriminately. They came on the landscape in the 90s. They were developed. Initially, they were thought to be less detrimental than other forms of insecticides. They're less toxic to vertebrates, but they are not without implications. Like I said, they're used very heavily in agriculture. In spring, when people are planting corn and soybeans, it's really hard, unless you're fully organic, excuse me, to come across a corn or soybean that isn't pre-treated with neonics. It's the reason why the corn seed is hot pink or blue or some weird color. It means it's pre-treated with these chemicals. And it was initially thought that this would be something that was really easy for farmers to, you know, get pest resistance or pest protection, do it once and not have to think about it again. So the idea was you plant the seed with the seed coating. The coating is taken up by the plant as it grows. Every part of that plant is now toxic to any insect predator. But the problem is most of that coating doesn't actually go into the plant. Studies suggest that upwards of 80% of that chemical doesn't go into the plant. It grows into the environment, so into the groundwater, into the surface water, into the soil, and into the air. And so
it's really pervasive.
It's pervasive. It persists in the environment for variable amounts of time. And again, it's because it is so mobile in water, it moves freely in the environment, and it's kind of showing up in places where we don't want it to.
So it's a widely used systemic pesticide, a class of pesticides in ag. And where might homeowners or the everyday person might find neonics?
Right. It's not just in agriculture. That's just the biggest use. You can go to any box store right now, and there's a lot of chemicals on the shelves that contain neonicotinoids, or neonics for short. That's a much easier word for folks. It's the reason too why, you know, when you look at hot spots of contamination in water samples, oftentimes it's urban settings where you'll see really high levels, and that's because of people using it on their landscapes and their yards. There's a recommended application that sometimes people don't follow really closely, and so you can get overuse, and that's why you get these hot spots. It's also found in, you know, a one way a regular homeowner might come into contact with this is through their pet products. A lot of us have dogs and cats in our house. We're often treating them for ticks and fleas. Those products often have neonics in them as well. And so, again, they're systemic. So if you give your dog, let's say, an oral flea and tick medicine, that medicine goes into its fur, it goes into its urine, it goes into its feces. And so there have been studies that kind of follow the environmental fate of these pet products, and they end up in some really, you know, strange places. They get washed off in the water, there was even this one disturbing study where there was enough pet fur that was collected by birds in preparing their nests that it was toxic to the growing chicks. So it's really, again, it's in surprising places and is really having some negative impacts environmentally.
Yeah, pervasive is right. You know, one of the most surprising claims that people hear is that neonic treated seeds often don't significantly improve yields.
Right.
And so what does the research actually show on that front?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me at the moment, but there has been a lot of research on this topic from Cornell, actually. They looked at yields in corn and soybean trials, and the take-home message was that in a lot of cases in corn, marginal benefits at best, and oftentimes the benefit didn't offset the the added cost of the pesticide that's applied in the seed coating. In soybeans, it was actually it was negative in some of the trials because the neonic was actually killing some of the beneficial insect predators that would, you know, go after these problematic pests during different times of the year. The problem, too, with these, there's often a mismatch in the timing. So by applying the seed coat in the spring, that's usually too early in most cases for some of these pest predators to start to show up on the landscape. And so you've missed your window of opportunity, really. There's just that mismatch in timing that doesn't work out. So no yield benefit and sometimes actually a negative impact thanks to the harm to the beneficial insects.
Wow, yeah. Beneficial insects are a huge part of our ecosystem and make such a difference in agricultural communities in ways that we don't have to do anything to get them to be on our farms. We just need to provide that kind of habitat for them. So yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you. I also wanted to ask about neonics as being really effective insecticides, but not selective ones. And I was just wondering if you've already mentioned that they're not selective, but why is that lack of selectivity such a concern for ecosystems?
Yeah, those broad spectrum insecticides are, you know, again, from a, I can see how someone might think that it's a good thing, right? You don't have to target a specific pest. It's just on the seed, it's in the plant. Any bad thing that shows up, it's gonna get rid of, and I don't have to think about it. But like you said, there's so many good insects and beneficial insects out there in the environment that are doing so much good work for us. Specifically, I'll draw attention to pollinators. They're vitally important for Wisconsin agriculture. So much of, and not just in Wisconsin, but globally, a third of our global food supply is directly linked to pollinators. And so, you know, if you're a pollinator and you come into contact with any of these contaminated plants, they are toxic, either directly toxic or will have sublethal impacts. So it'll affect their reproductive ability, their motor skills. These are neurotoxins. So anything related to movement or navigation is going to be affected. So we're inadvertently, by using these pesticides in the environment, we're having these really negative impacts on these really important pollinators, for example, that are vitally important for Wisconsin agriculture, but also, you know, they're just good for our ecosystems and we need them for healthy ecosystems in Wisconsin.
Yeah, absolutely. I know people often focus on honeybees, mm-hmm. and it's always funny because I like to compare the concern, you know, yes, honeybees, there are concerns about them, but they are a non-native mm-hmm. insect. They are not native to our area, our continent, and I compare the concern for honeybees, you know, when people say save the bees and they focus on honeybees, mm-hmm. it's like saying save the birds and focusing on chickens. Honeybees are our livestock. They're a domesticated animal. We have trained them and bred them to focus on what we want them to do, which is make honey for us that we can collect, as well as, you know, pollinate large scale agricultural fields. But so I would love it if you could talk a little bit about how honeybees and wild bees, native bees, are also connected here.
Yeah, a lot of the research, for better or for worse, has been on honeybees because they have such a, you know, such an important economic impact on agriculture. But like you mentioned, there hasn't been as much research on native bee species, but the little that there is, they're even more impacted, more susceptible, more vulnerable to the effects, excuse me, of these pesticides. And, you know, even taking a step from what we have learned from honeybees is that we do have this they lose their ability to navigate, right? So that instead of going directly back and forth from the hive to this pollen source that they've found, they get lost or they make detours or their navigation is severely impacted. And there's other sublethal impacts as well. But whatever's happening to honeybees, it's more dramatic in the wild bee population.
Right. And it seems the case also for other pollinators like butterflies, even other flies, you know, other insects too. So these are all species that are affected by neonicotinoids, and there's more even beyond that too.
The striking thing to me, so that, you know, the monarch butterfly is sort of this iconic species, right, that everyone has some attachment to. But the thing about neonics is they move in water and they're persistent in soil. And so certain neonics can live in the soil for a really long period of time, like tens of years, especially if you're thinking about, think if you're in a soy corn rotation and you just have that repeated neonic year after year after year after year, it's building up in the soil. And so even if, you know, you're beneficial, we know that monarch butterflies need milkweed, right?
Yeah.
So if you just happen to be a milkweed that's growing in this contaminated soil, that plant has also taken up that pesticide. And so, you know, the monarch needs the milkweed, but if it's growing in contaminated soil, it's probably killing that monarch. So, you know, even this persistent soil legacy problem is very real. And again, having really outsized impacts for that nobody really anticipated when these came on the market. The other thing that, you know, they're not providing yield benefits in most cases, and they're not cheap. Like, they're, you know, farmers put these in the field at great expense every year. And really it's these major chemical companies that are making the bulk of the money from this. And, you know, we're not seeing yield increases that warrant that cost. And the environmental risks are so great. So it's really, in my opinion, not worth the cost environmentally or financially.
Yeah, I would agree. It seems that a lot of it is fear-based marketing, which is predatory. I mean, it's asking farmers or telling farmers that they need to be paying more when sometimes the benefits aren't there and the risks may not be addressed with that treatment too.
It's often, I think it's sold to people as an insurance policy in some cases, like, oh, well, you know, if you use this product, you've covered your bases essentially, and we're ready for whatever comes this year. But it's not true in most cases. You know, maybe you'll have an early season pest and maybe it will be effective against that. But again, because of that mismatch in the timing and the fact that so little of that active chemical is actually going into the plant is, it's not worth it.
yeah. And so you were talking about how it remains in the soil, and a lot of soil has neonics. Is there a way for people to test for neonicotinoids in their soil or in their water even?
It's hard to test for. I think you can do it through the fact that I even don't have that answer at the tip of my tongue.
It was a surprise
something.
Question.
No. It's a good one though. Like I get that someone asked me that at the Prairie Enthusiast discussion that we had, and because you want to know, especially if you're doing these large scale. You come into property that has had this constant rotation of corner soy for many years and you want to do native plantings on it, like that's something you definitely have to consider, is it still here? You know, you want to get your soil tested, and you definitely want to get, it is showing up in our groundwater, it's showing up in our surface water. There's a study in 2022 done by the DNR where they just picked 100 random sites in the state, and upwards of, I think it was 60% of those samples contain neonics. So, you know, you want to get your water tested. Right. It's not usually part of as far as I know, like it's not part of the homeowner package. It would be a special test that you would have to request from State Lab of Hygiene, most likely.
Yeah, I'm doing a little bit of Googling just as we're talking, just to see if we can get some answers for listeners. But it does look like there's neonicotinoid pesticide tests from the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Not sure how expensive it is, but there's other labs that will do that testing too. So it is possible to get it tested, which is, I think, the most important takeaway there.
Yeah.
In regards to, you know, we talked about soil a little bit, but I want to also talk about water and how aquatic insects and freshwater ecosystems are affected by neonic contamination. We have many different watersheds in our area, many different streams and rivers, mm-hmm. and freshwater is so important.
Yes, absolutely. It was actually folks from Trout Unlimited who reached out to me a few years ago with this kind of observation that, you know, we're just not seeing the insect hatches like we used to. We're not seeing the densities of bugs. We're not seeing, you know, the diversity of species that we have in the past. And fly anglers especially are kind of cued into that because it's, you know, what fly you put on any given stream on any given day is kind of dictated by the aquatic life in that stream. And it is, you know, you said you're also the water, you do the Water Action Volunteers program. So there are one great way to really quickly tell you the health of your watershed is to look at what bugs live there. And generally speaking, if you have the mayflies, the caddisflies, the stoneflies in your stream, it's generally a pretty good indicator of good, healthy water quality. When we have these pesticides showing up in water, certain species are especially susceptible, especially it looks like mayflies don't do very well with neonics. Other species just aren't as well studied. There isn't as much data, but yeah, they're definitely having impacts at the in the water. One big study, there's a researcher out of La Crosse that's been looking at the mayfly hatches on the Mississippi River. He compared data from I don't want to get the years wrong, but I think it was 2023 compared to some previous decades. And what he noticed is that there's been a 45% decline in the Hexagenia mayfly hatches. And those are the burrowing mayflies are the ones that are, I've been told, at least this happened before I moved to Wisconsin, but the hatches were so big at times that, you know, snow plows were necessary to get all the bugs off the bridges on the Mississippi River, just these massive emergences. And if you go on the National Weather Service website, you can see the archived imagery of this. It looks like huge storm events that are actually just bugs coming off the river, which is amazing. And starting when I was digging around on the website a little bit, it looked like 2012 was one of the last years when there was like these really big, massive emergences. And since then, you know, you get smaller emergences or, you know, here and there scattered throughout, but nothing like we used to see. And it's happening, you know, that research is backed by people's experience and what they've seen. So, and at an ecosystem level, that has huge implications. You think about the volume of bugs that are coming off the river at any given time, and that accounts for trillions of calories that end up in, you know, not just in the river fish, but in the bats, in the birds, anything that lives in that riverine corridor. And so, you know, if you lose that huge food supply, it's definitely going to have major implications in the rest of the food web.
Yeah, nutrient cycling in our ecosystems is huge there in terms of mayfly hatches. And mm-hmm. I'm sure some listeners can even recall huge mayfly hatches along the Wisconsin River decades ago. And I wonder what they would also say about what they've seen and the changes there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, regarding, you know, aquatics and dramatic declines in freshwater species, I'm wondering what you have personally noticed in Wisconsin landscapes or waterways during your career that make those trends feel real to you.
Yeah, it's fun to talk. Well, like I said, I'm a Wisconsin transplant. I'm originally from South Dakota, but I've been living here for about 10 years now in the Driftless area. And again, like the thing that's been most noticeable to me is the changes in insect life, both in the water and in the air. Even growing up in South Dakota, I know it's South Dakota versus Wisconsin, but you couldn't drive anywhere without having a windshield just full of bugs. And anytime you fueled up, you had to wash your windshield because they were just so thick. And, you know, we don't really have that happen anymore. There just aren't, it doesn't seem like there's as many bugs around. Mm-hmm. Same thing, like we talked about monarch butterflies. I just remember they were everywhere as a kid, and now it's like a big deal to see a few every year during the migration. And I don't know, it's from a terrestrial lens, it's pretty remarkable. But again, in the water, like we have so many miles of stream here in the Driftless area, and you know, I'm not on the water as much. My husband's on the water every day and notices and reports back. And he's also noticed a really significant shift in what's there and what time it's there and how many there are. Just over the course of, you know, the last 10 years, it's become noticeable.
So yeah.
It's happening in real time. And that's one of the things, too, when you talk to people, I don't know, this kind of leads into a different question or a different topic, but you know, climate change is such a loaded topic for folks that sometimes it's better to not even use those words. But if you talk to people about their lived experience and what they're seeing, and you know, you start to hear these stories like, you know, it rained in January, or you know, it was really dry this time of year, and it was really wet this time of year, and this never used to happen. And you know, so people are starting to, they notice that because they've experienced it themselves. We're not calling it the same thing necessarily, but we're all talking about the same thing. And that's just an entry point to at least have the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we just talked a little bit about how there's been this insect decline broadly. And so how do neonicotinoids, we talked a little bit about birds earlier, but how do they affect things like birds and fish that rely on insects for food?
It's one of those things that... the more research gets done, the more impacts there are that we didn't even realize. So, like I said, the bees got the most attention early on. There's been more studies on aquatic invertebrates, birds, like you said. But we're even seeing impacts to terrestrial animals like deer. And that makes sense because, you know, deer eat a lot of corn out of fields that are treated with seeds. And they also, you know, there's... spill piles that happen inadvertently sometimes, and deer key in on those areas. So they're sometimes eating really massive amounts in one sitting. And so what we're seeing in deer at least is birth defects. There's a study in Minnesota where I can't remember the percentage, but it was upwards of 90%, I believe, of the deer that they tested contained neonics. And yeah, changes in their jawbone structure, like it's happening in real time. And again, initially they were thought to be less toxic to vertebrates, and what we're seeing is just that doesn't seem to be the case. And we're seeing impacts to human health as well, especially infants. Again, it's a neurotoxin, and there's a different study where they looked at pregnant women specifically, and 95% of the women they tested had neonics in their bodies, which is alarming. So we're all coming into contact with these chemicals all the time. And I have to believe there are going to be some long-term health implications to that as well.
Yeah, and hopefully policy changes too.
Yes.
And so I do want to end on a kind of a more positive note, and I'm wondering if there are any recent legislative actions or actions that companies are taking around neonics.
There are a lot of good examples to draw from of success stories. These chemicals have been banned in the European Union since 2013. And so, you know, they started to realize what the negative impacts were, put some regulations in place to try to curb the use. And Canada followed suit more recently. They have what's called a verification of need policy now. So instead of just being able to plant these seeds, these coded seeds. You have to prove that you need it. You have to basically get a prescription from your agronomist that says, in this particular circumstance, they will be beneficial. And just that one action took, you know, it was used almost in 100% of the corn and 60% of the soybeans. Those percentages are now like 0.5% of, and almost zero for soy. So, I mean, just that one thing had such a big impact. So I could see something like that hopefully taking hold in Wisconsin. There's some state examples as well. New York kind of led the way starting in 2027. They're limiting house landscape use by, I think it's landscape use. And then starting in 2029, they're going to have regulation around banning the seed coating. So again, the more this catches on, I'm hoping that we have some positive examples to draw from that we can do something similar here.
Well, I wish we had more time for questions. I think that's all that we have time for today, but this is such an intriguing topic, and we're so grateful to have you on today, Ellen, to talk to us about neonicotinoids. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great to talk to you.